Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
There is still no state budget proposal from the General Assembly. The stumbling block, Medicaid expansion in Virginia. I'm Maylilly Lee. Thanks for joining us. If lawmakers cannot come up with a spending plan for the next 2 years by July 1st, the state government might have to shut down. At the heart of the budget impasse is whether or not to expand Medicaid benefits under the Affordable Care Act. It's estimated the expansion would benefit some 400,000 low-income and disabled Virginians. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government would pay for expanding Medicaid for the first 3 years, then pay 90% of the cost thereafter. Proponents of the plan say the state would receive $5 million a day if it expands Medicaid. Opponents remain skeptical of promises made by Washington. Joining us to help sort it all out are reporters covering the budget stalemate in the General Assembly. They are Julian Walker, Richmond reporter for the Virginian Pilot, and Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We've also extended invitations to members of the House Appropriations Committee and Senate Finance Committee, as well as the governor's office. Hopefully they can call in and share their ideas. We'll not be limiting our conversation to just the budget. We're going to talk about some other issues and topics around the General Assembly and around the state as well. But I do want to begin with the budget, since it is going to be a focal point on Monday as lawmakers return for their special session of the General Assembly. Now, we're not the only state to have a special session largely hinging around Medicaid expansion. Arizona had a surprise special session last year. Its Republican governor, Jan Brewer, signed the expansion for Arizona. 26 states and D.C. are expanding Medicaid in their states. Others are pending or showing no interest in expanding Medicaid. So let me start with you, Julian. What happens to Virginia when it doesn't show up on that list of states on board for Medicaid expansion?
Well, several things happen. It really depends on the perspective that you look at the question from. If you're a hospital, for example, and the Hospital and Healthcare Association here in Virginia is lobbying heavily in favor of expansion or a plan akin to expansion, if you are them, the cuts that are coming to the indigent care payments that hospitals receive are going to be reduced under the Federal Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, depending on the verbiage you prefer to use. So for hospitals, it's a reduction in funding. If you are someone who is a fiscal conservative, you look at this issue and say, why should I believe that a broken Washington, a Washington that is debt-laden, will be able to fulfill its commitment to provide the lion's share of the funding for this population of new enrollees? So what happens to Virginia really depends on the perspective of the group that you represent or the constituency that you represent. If you are a local government and there is no budget by July 1, as you pointed out, those localities rely on pass-through state funding, as do many, many programs, state government programs and local programs that rely on state support. So it washes through the entire budget from the state level to the local level, and it has ramifications not just for public entities but for private ones as well.
Okay. One of the arguments made by Republicans across the country is that the federal government will make promises, and down the road we will find that those promises start to shift. And I think of it along the lines of buying a timeshare, you know, when you first show up and you do the three-hour tour and then you get the LCD TV. You're told this is a great hedge against inflation. Buy a timeshare now, lock in at this yearly maintenance fee, and the fee will never change. 10 years later, you find that the fee is changing and that there are arguments made for why your originally $300 a year maintenance fee is now over $1,000 a year. And I think Republicans are concerned that the federal government is making promises they will not deliver. And here is a quote from Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana. He is a Republican governor who has concerns that Medicaid expansion could cost Louisiana taxpayers up to $1.7 billion. saying that the first 10 years of implementation, the costs will keep rising. Even President Obama has previously supported a blended federal matching rate, which is a euphemism for shifting costs to the states, he says. Even if you believe the federal government will keep its promises and won't further shift costs to states, advocates for Obamacare admit the federal subsidies are front-loaded and that expansion will eventually cost the states. That's a key argument of Republicans.
It certainly is. And remember that right now the existing or traditional Medicaid program in Virginia is about a 50-50 split between the state and the federal in terms of funding. That ratio differs depending on the state. For wealthier states, it tends to be more in the kind of 50-50 ratio or more in the kind of even-Steven sharing, whereas for poorer states, the feds pick up a greater share or a greater split of that amount. As you pointed out at the top of the hour, at the beginning, the federal government is offering to pay 100% of the coverage cost for new enrollees. That gradually phases down, and by 2020, that gets you down to 90%. Now, the question is, will Washington be able to live up to that obligation? But beyond that, to give voice to the concerns that Republicans have expressed, there is also this notion that there are some hidden or unforeseen costs, because as the cost, as Washington's share of covering the new enrollees decreases, there are also costs that the state are going to have to bear, not just for the new enrollees, but for administrative things as well. One thing that Republicans have argued in Virginia, for example, is that think about how this washes down to the local level. Medicaid largely is administered on the local level through local social service agencies. And so do those agencies have to hire new workers just in order to deal with the influx, the anticipated influx of people who would be new enrollees? So there certainly are costs that could be passed on to Virginia in terms of the decreasing federal share, as well as some unanticipated costs. Those who support this, though, would argue that this state has been taking federal dollars, continues to take federal dollars for years and years and years, decades and decades, in fact, and that money has always come through. So might there be unanticipated costs or unexpected costs that state and localities would have to bear? Yes, but to the notion that you can't count on Washington, if you look at Virginia's history, we certainly – our history of budgeting, we certainly have relied repeatedly and regularly on Washington funding for an array of programs.
Okay, I'm going to turn to you, Jeff. Your thoughts on the promises made by the federal government and why Republicans are skeptical.
Maybe a bit skeptical.
I'm going to get you.
Good morning.
Morning.
The government of Virginia, in the hands of Democrats and Republicans, has joyously and happily built programs around federal largesse, some of it highly speculative. Back in the 90s, when the anti-tax fervor was really taking root in Virginia, the General Assembly and the governor, a Republican, issued bonds based on the anticipation of federal dollars to construct and improve roads. This is, I fear, largely an argument about politics and increasingly not about policy. If you parse a lot of the statements, even by the Republican leadership, Speaker Howell, Chris Jones, they have left for themselves a very slender, if only rhetorical, out. So the idea here is not to say no entirely to the federal government, but insist on some type of reform, some type of improvements, some type of changes in advance. This is largely to accommodate the Republican base, an increasingly conservative base, just as Governor McAuliffe, a Democrat, is trying to accommodate an increasingly liberal base by pressing this issue. And even Republicans will tell you, maybe not for the record, but certainly privately, that this has a lot more to do about the dynamics of legislative election politics. 2015, the House and Senate are up. Using Tommy Norment, the Republican leader, as an example, this is the ultimate deal maker, someone who, for the most part, is moderate by default, but he's right there with the naysayers. And that has a lot to do with protecting his right. He wants to be the Republican majority leader again in the Senate, and that's not a position he can count on if he goes wobbly on health care.
Is it a matter of semantics if the right Republicans can fashion the term Obamacare and into something else that is more palatable, then it's okay to endorse it? I mean, I talked about the Arizona governor, who is a Republican governor, who did sign into law Medicaid expansion in that state. But for the most part, it does seem that no one wants, who's a Republican, wants to add their name to something called Obamacare, but in spirit is interested in this kind of extension. The exception would be those Republicans who feel that we shouldn't move toward privatization, or we should move toward privatization and away from handouts from the government. But there seem to be many who are in theory in favor, but who, for the reasons of not wanting to sign on to anything with Obama's name, want to figure out a way around this.
Well, the Republicans will acknowledge that they've gotten a good deal of mileage out of the health care issue. There were special elections in Virginia following the statewide elections, by the way, the statewide elections in which Terry McAuliffe, who looked like he was having a big heading to a big win, really didn't, because it appeared that Ken Cuccinelli was able to close strongly because of the health care issue. And in those special elections, there was a seat for the state Senate drawn for a Democrat that the Democrats barely managed to hold on to. In large part, the Republicans believe, by emphasizing the Obamacare issue. So this is not a theme that the Republicans are going to give up easily. But it's very early in this process. It's only April. The real deadline is June 30th. And depending on how they peel this onion, there might be a budget in place by July 1st, which would be the when one would have to have a budget in place, but it might be a little later in the summer before that health care fix is fully implemented.
The Obamacare issue is showing up in elections. It's showing up in people's talking points. And Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie are likely to be matched up in the Senate election. We want to ask you and ask our audience, is Gillespie likely to edge out Warner on Obamacare alone? What do you guys think?
Well, I think to Jeff's point, I think it will certainly be an issue that will be highlighted by Republicans. We're already seeing that. And we're seeing Democrats attempting to push back on that by arguing that Ed Gillespie, the presumptive Republican nominee, let's not forget there are three other candidates in that field vying for that nomination at a Republican convention in Roanoke in June. But Mr. Gillespie is the presumptive nominee, and already we're seeing Obamacare, national health care emerge as an issue in that race. But as I pointed out, Democrats are trying to reshape that and point out that Ed Gillespie, in his lobbying days, took one position on the individual mandate, and now that he is a candidate, they argue he is taking a different position, a position in opposition to the Federal Health Care Act. And they point out they are attempting to brand him a flip-flopper, as Democrats did perhaps somewhat successfully in 2012 with Mitt Romney, that he was for it, now he's against it.
And, you know, in politics, best defense is a good offense. Mark Warner has introduced, along with about half a dozen other Senate Democrats up for re-election this year, fixes to Obamacare. Most of those other senators are on the endangered list. The Warner votes in favor of Obamacare got him in a lot of trouble with his default Republican and Republican business friends.
Would you say that it was a fatal mistake of Warner to vote in favor of Obamacare?
I don't think it is a fatal mistake. He's got a base to tend to as well. And let's just look at this as a policy issue for a moment, if I may seem to contradict myself. Looking at rural Virginia, the 9th Congressional District, the far southwest, which Warner carried twice as governor and then as a candidate for the U.S. Senate, there are just vast numbers of people who are lacking in health care. This properly packaged by Warner, who fancies himself the fixer, may be a stronger talking point by virtue of what he is trying to do, if only rhetorically. Now, the Republicans, thinking of this campaign sort of as a whiteboard exercise, seem to feel, and I think there's something to this, that in a thinly or more thinly tended election, Obama's unpopularity in a state he's carried twice and unpopularity or distaste for Obamacare are negatives that can be used to really close the gap. Even the Republicans will say defeating Warner requires threading the needle very carefully.
Okay. We have a call from John from Blacksburg. Good morning, John. You have a suggestion on the budget.
Yes. The Republicans' number one argument is that they're worried that come 2020 or sometime after that, the federal government will renege on its promise and won't pay its part of the money. So there's enough lawyers in the House and in the Senate and working for them. Why don't they write the law to say that once the 90% or $9 for $1 thing kicks in, that's how much we'll spend. We'll spend $1 for every $9 the federal government gives us, and if the federal government doesn't give us what they say they're going to give, we just won't spend that much.
Not a bad idea. John, are you yourself a lawyer?
No, I'm not.
What are you, if not a lawyer?
I'm a courier.
All right. We sure do appreciate your input this morning. And Jeff?
Julian remembers this quite well, that when Governor McAuliffe got a shot at introducing a budget of his own, and very unusual for a newbie governor, one of the things that he proposed was, you know, full-on Medicaid expansion, but for 2 years. And what he was trying to do is make the point to the Republicans, now in opposition, that if they're unhappy with the way this thing is going, one can pull the plug. Of course, the timing is important because it would have meant all of this would have been implemented at the height of a legislative election. Republicans were worried about having to play defense with their base as well as a general electorate. And as a result, that went nowhere.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We're talking with Jeff Shapiro and Julian Walker, and we'll have some more about the General Assembly, not only the budget, but other issues as well. But first, this reminder that next week, urban agriculture and how more localities around the state are working to use green spaces for gardens. That's on the next Virginia Conversations. And be sure to check out all of our archived programs by going to virginiapublicradio.org. Stay with us. We'll have more on the state budget and more in just a moment. Today we're discussing the deadlock in the General Assembly over the state budget. Our guests are Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and Julian Walker, Richmond reporter for the Virginian Pilot. Let's turn to a call from Williamsburg. Good morning, Dean. How are you?
One thing that's been disturbing me a little bit on this program is that no one's talking about those poor people on the bottom end who don't get any help or support for their health care. All you're talking about is politics and whether you're going to get elected or not. And the question is, what about the poor people, the 400,000 people who are not going to get any health care?
And this is a good point.
Well, to the caller's remark, that is what Democrats are arguing. They are trying to paint and present the human face on this problem, on this issue. There are about 1 million Virginians right now who are without health care. Under a Medicaid expansion population or some other alternative, it is estimated, as the caller said, that as many as 400,000 people could obtain coverage, subsidized government coverage. The uptake rate on that is probably going to be around 60 or 70%. So you're looking at an actual enrollment number probably in the neighborhood of 250,000. And let's just define this population if we can quickly. this population is a group of people right now in Medicaid. Virginia has one of the more miserly Medicaid programs in the nation. The people who are eligible are pregnant women, children, and age-blind and disabled adults. Those are the people that are eligible right now, so a pretty narrowly defined population. Under an expansion population or an expansion model, you would have largely working adults who meet income eligibility guidelines to participate in the program. Many of these estimates are about 70% of these people are working adults. And these are people who kind of fall in what proponents call the coverage gap. That is, people who aren't poor enough, aren't the poorest of the poor who qualify for existing Medicaid in Virginia, and people who aren't earning enough to qualify for the health benefit exchange where you can purchase through a private marketplace subsidized insurance with government subsidies. And so the people that are in that middle, that kind of nebulous area, that limbo, those are the people in the so-called coverage gap. They are largely adults. The majority of them are working adults, but they are not making a significant living wage, if you will. Right now, the people that would qualify, annual earnings would be about $15,000 for an individual. For a family of four, it's about $32,000, $33,000.
Dean, does that help?
Another question. What if the minimum wage was raised? Would that allow those people in the donut hole to provide insurance?
Well, the minimum wage in Virginia, at least, and it's still up in the air in Washington, but in Virginia, legislation to increase the minimum wage from $7.25 to $9.25 or to a figure commensurate with whatever Washington might do. Those bills were defeated this year in the General Assembly. There is an interesting paradox, though, there, and this is a bit of a hypothetical, but if the minimum wage were to be raised, if you actually compute that math out, some of the people who right now would be Medicaid expansion eligible might, in fact, if you're in a household of four, for example, and you've got a couple people who are working minimum wage jobs, they could find themselves in a quandary where they could earn themselves out of Medicaid expansion eligibility depending on a potential increase in the minimum wage. Again, that's a hypothetical because Virginia has rejected legislation to increase its minimum wage.
Thank you so much for your call, Dean. Another point that should be made, and this is reverberated throughout the Republican Party, the quote that our policies should be designed so that more people are pulling the cart rather than riding in the cart. We should measure success by reducing the number of people on public assistance. And as this one person said, but the left has been very clear. Their goal is to transform all health care in America into government-run health care. Another quote by Governor Bobby Jindal. So we turn now to another caller, Bob from Augusta County. You want to talk about Medicaid, but specifically the legislators' stand on Medicaid. Which ones? Which side of the aisle, Bob?
Yes, I live in – are you calling me now?
Yes, uh-huh. We're calling to – first, let me find out which side of the aisle you'll be speaking from. Republican, Democrat?
Well, I'm going to tell you this. In Augusta County, I'm represented by two Republicans. One is Emmett Hanger in the Senate, who is one of the three Republicans who's been moderate enough to support Medicaid expansion. I'm also represented in the lower house by Dickie Bell, an adamant opponent of this. The two of them were interviewed at some length on WMRA last week. What struck me was that Dickie Bell, who has been a high school teacher all of his life and a teacher of disabled kids and a coach, knows very well how many people in Augusta County are in this group of low-income people who don't get any Medicare. He never once mentioned a person. He spoke only of the policy. He spoke only along the lines of Secretary Speaker Howell. Emmett Hanger, on the other hand, I think is much more representative of opinion here in Augusta County. And interestingly, since you mentioned the fear of some of these people to be challenged from the right, Emmett was in fact challenged from the right last time he ran, and he won handily. So he's an example of a person who can be reasonable, of moderate, and still a Republican. But Dickie Bell is an example, I think, of blindness on the other side of things.
To the caller's point about Emmett Hanger, he has been foursquare on this from day one. He's among three Republicans, John Watkins from Powhatan on the edges of the Richmond area, and Walter Stosch from Henrico, one of the certainly prosperous suburbs. These three amigos seem to be hanging tough along with the 20 Democrats. And I suspect on Monday when the legislature returns that the Senate will affirm its version of the budget, probably not even bother to take up for matters of procedure and protocol the House version of the budget. All of that's intended to kind of run down the clock, give both sides another shot at jazzing up their base and dragging this issue well into spring.
Jeff, I want to play a little game with you. You do a very good job of voicing those various and sundry lawmaker stances. And as you know, we had an aborted call from Louise Lucas, Democrat from Portsmouth. Some time ago, I remember a story about a young reporter who was sent out to a crime scene where a homicide had taken place. And he goes up to the woman and says, ma'am, how did it feel to have your son killed? And she said, oh, well, that wasn't my son. And the reporter said, well, how would you have felt if it were? So let me ask you, what would Louise Lucas have said if her call weren't aborted?
Senator Lucas and Julian, of course, who covers her very closely as a Hampton Roads political correspondent.
We'll get you both in.
Would make very clear that she's very much for what the Senate has endorsed, which has been that private marketplace alternative. I think all things being equal, she'd be perfectly happy with, balls out Medicaid expansion. But, it's a political process. It requires compromise. So we're told this is the best the Senate can do at this time. And Senator Lucas is a committee chair, education and health, very much in the leadership, knows how this process is played.
Julian.
I think Jeff hit the nail on the head there. I think Louise Lucas is an ardent supporter of expanding Medicaid, whether it be through a full-on expansion, which is what Governor McAuliffe has proposed in that two-year pilot program that Jeff mentioned earlier, or the kind of compromise option that has won the support of the three Republicans Jeff mentioned, the Marketplace Virginia sort of private option model to kind of run it through the private insurance marketplace. I also thought it was a good point that Jeff made about in response to the previous caller who raised the question about Emmett Hanger. I think both Emmett Hanger and John Watkins have publicly said, if I get a challenge from the right, so be it. And so they consider themselves standing on principle, the opponents of this likewise.
Walter Stosch has been challenged from the right previously because of his support of higher taxes in 2004. And Julian, as he was discussing, elaborating on Senator Lucas's position, reminded me that, her district really is probably a good example of just how many different kinds of people are potentially helped, depending on, of course, on one's perspective, by some type of a health care fix. The anchor of her district is urban Portsmouth, with facing lots of the problems that urban areas, majority African American urban areas, often face. But it reaches into the rural underbelly of southern Virginia, where there are considerable gaps in the health care system, to use the argot of the health care fix proponents.
Good morning, Carol. You're from Natural Bridge.
Yes.
Great to have you on the show. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to comment on the fact that the GOP does not care for giving back to the American public what the American public pays in taxes. And this includes infrastructure such as bridges and what have you. It includes Obamacare and many other items that would come back to the Americans. This is sad, in my opinion. They give plenty of money to Mexico, Russia, Japan, whoever. And the American public, when it asks for money or help, it gets none.
Taxpayers should get some of their money back.
Yes, I believe so. It's nice to have some goodies come back to you in some form.
And how are you feeling as you watch the General Assembly go back for its special session on Monday? Are you confused? Are you frustrated?
No, I think it's very political, and I haven't really been watching the General Assembly, I'm afraid.
That's quite all right. That's what we're here for. We thank you for chiming in today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot been going on in Natural Bridge. You know, the Natural Bridge is actually going to change hands. That's been a big story out your way.
We want to also talk about some of the other issues facing the General Assembly. This week, Jeff, the governor had an opportunity to veto or sign, and that's ongoing through, you said, Wednesday.
That's correct. This is the post-session review. The governor has 30 days to sign this stuff, propose revisions, veto it. There have been a couple of vetoes so far, one of which has to do with how guns, private weapons, are stored or not in motor vehicles. Another has to do with prayer by Virginia National Guard units. There have been other bills signed by the governor, one of which has to do with a minor international incident, which the legislature and McAuliffe have triggered, requiring that Virginia textbooks refer to the body of water separating Japan and the Koreas as the East Sea, as well as the Sea of Japan, a hard-fought bill. Korean Americans, abundant in Northern Virginia, feel very strongly about this. The government of Japan, the chrysanthemum throne, if you will, feels very strongly about preserving the Sea of Japan designation. The ambassador met with the governor on this issue. And I suspect one could make the argument there are a lot of dollars involved in this. Japan and South Korea and natives of both countries who are here in significant numbers pump a lot of money into the Virginia economy.
Okay. And you're following these as well?
Absolutely. I think Jeff's point about the geographic hubbub, if you will, that many of those South Pacific countries are major trade partners, agricultural trade partners with Virginia. So there's a lot of sensitivity going on there. But yes, so far the governor has only vetoed two pieces of legislation, as Jeff mentioned, the one about storing handguns in your vehicle, whether they have to be locked or simply secured in containers. The governor vetoed legislation that would make it clear that they didn't have to be locked. And then the other bill, the National Guard sermonizing bill, if you will, was about whether or not in a mandatory event, a public event, if you could offer kind of a sectarian or proselytizing message, or if it had to be kind of sanitized or non-sectarian. And that, I think, begets another kind of separation of church and state issue that is pending before him, which is the school prayer bill from Senator Bill Carrico out in Grayson County in Southwest Virginia. And that is another one that you might expect to see a veto on at some point.
That's Julian Walker, Richmond reporter for the Virginian Pilot. And we're also joined by Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Earlier, we talked about the upcoming Senate election for Senator Mark Warner's seat. Now let's shift to U.S. House primaries. First of all, we're looking at House Majority Leader Cantor, who's been forever in his position, and some possible opposition coming up.
Actual opposition.
Actual opposition.
Dave Bratt.
Materialized opposition.
Dave Bratt, an economics professor at Randolph-Macon up the road in Ashland, running to Cantor's right, Tea Party libertarian in his tone and view. It's going to be very difficult to defeat Congressman Cantor. Incumbents, for the most part, are difficult to extract. But in these made-to-order districts, in this case a made-to-order Republican district, the conventional wisdom is that the best way to knock off an incumbent is during the nomination phase. But Dave Bratt's going to have a lot of trouble meeting some of those basic tests of credibility. For example, we'll be seeing some campaign fundraising reports in mid-April, and I suspect there's going to be a lopsided advantage for the gentleman from Henrico. Remember, we're talking about the head of the Republican majority in the United States House of Representatives, you know, a heartbeat from the speakership. Cantor's made no secret of his interest in succeeding John Boehner as Speaker. In fact, earlier in his career, he appeared to do what he could perhaps to destabilize the Boehner speakership. So Eric Cantor is someone who has to be watched carefully. By the way, that made-to-order district allows Cantor to really concentrate on his primary, pun intended, interest, and that is his national constituency, this restive Republican caucus in the U.S. House.
And I think Jeff makes an interesting point about the fundraising aspect of this in the upcoming campaign finance reports we're going to see. Your listeners may have seen the Supreme Court decision this week essentially eliminating or lifting the individual political contribution caps that had existed before. That is going to, I would anticipate, and I'm sure Jeff can address this as well, really going to send fundraising for both the congressional contest and the Senate race here in Virginia, the anticipated showdown between Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie, to the moon. As we know, in 2012, the race between Tim Kaine and George Allen was the most expensive Senate race in the nation that year.
That is Julian Walker, Richmond reporter for the Virginian Pilot. Also joined by Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And we will remind you that Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. Find out also about upcoming topics by checking us out on Facebook. Search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We'll be back with more around the General Assembly in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today we're talking about Medicaid expansion in Virginia and other issues around the state. Our guests are Julian Walker, Richmond reporter for the Virginian Pilot, and Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We go to Williamsburg for this call from Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Just great.
Good. My comment or suggestion is, I think one of the main problems with Medicaid is that the states have for many, many years, at least 30, used Medicaid as a source for additional income and really not used the money properly. And it's been the states that were doing it, not the federal government. The two that I visited on a study that I did for the House Appropriations Committee were New Jersey and Louisiana, both of which had some really wonderful ways to feed their budget. And I've been concerned about this. Well, it ended up that the person who asked us to do the study with the for the House Appropriations Committee was the chairman of the committee back in the that time frame, and we were asked to change the study, we told him no, and he round filed it or threw it in the wastebasket.
Okay, thank you for that call.
The indication that they're short, that they're short money out of this whole thing is a real red herring, because they're really not short money. They over budget every year. It's one of their tricks, and then don't have to return it at the end of the year the way you would if you don't spend your money. You have to give it back. The state budget this money. Budget too much money and then end up not spending it on medical care for the indigent, but rather spend it on things like roads and whatever else they think they can get through their own Congress.
Okay, Paul, thanks so much.
Sure would like to know who that House Appropriations Committee chairman was and a bit more on when that that report was prepared. But one of the points that the McAuliffe administration makes, and to some degree even House Republicans acknowledge is a possibility, is that with these additional Medicaid dollars, there can be a freeing up of other dollars for other priorities. So when Governor McAuliffe put his short-lived version of the budget on the table, one of the its features were savings of $200 million or more that could go into, among other things, sweeter pay raises for public employees. So one of the talking points, certainly for the governor and proponents of a health care fix, is that availing itself of Washington's largesse, Virginia can save money.
One thing that one wonders, that one thing the governor did not do early on, and this is because he was coming in and this was originally not his budget, as Jeff pointed out earlier. This was a bit of an anomaly because of how things played out this year that he was able to introduce his own version of the budget or his own package of amendments on the budget. But one wonders if the governor wouldn't have been better served had he not reached out to some of those interest groups, the educators, et cetera, and said to them in more concrete terms, this is what you will get if you come up and step up to the plate for me and support me as I try to get this Medicaid expansion done. There was a lot of kind of conceptual or vague ideas floated about, well, there'd be more money for this, more money for that. We could put some in a trust fund. But there wasn't a lot of concrete examples of how that money would be spent other than these savings will – you know, be the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Here's another call from Joel from Richmond. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, okay, good. I'm an independent. I usually vote Democratic or at least against the Republicans here in this state. The thing that drives me up the wall is that the Democrats have done such a poor job of selling all the benefits of expansion of the Medicare and Obamacare in general. The first one would be I used to, in my working life, run a $400 million portfolio of consumer receivables. Probably 40% of our bankruptcies that we wrote off were due to unforeseen medical expenses that these people couldn't afford. And we lost the money, and generally those families lost everything. The other thing about expanding Medicare would give some structure to what medical fees are. Most hospitals have two rates that they charge. If you don't have insurance, you may pay $50,000 for a surgical procedure that actually an insurance company only pays $10,000 for. And once you codify that and get everything structured, I think the families and the businesses all would do much better.
Joel, that's
there
very appreciated.
There is at least one hospital in the state that gives an automatic 50% discount.
Thank you for that insight.
Joel's onto something, particularly the teaching hospitals, the Virginia-run teaching hospitals, the Medical College of Virginia here in Richmond and the University of Virginia teaching hospital up at Charlottesville feel very strongly about expansion, in part because it will create not only another source of cash but a structure of fees.
Setting aside Medicaid expansion for just a moment, we promised that we would talk about some other issues facing the Commonwealth, and this week, the federal judge overseeing the class action challenge to Virginia's same-sex marriage ban filed by Lambda Legal and the ACLU, Harris versus Rainey, has decided to put that case on hold. A similar challenge to Virginia's ban will be argued in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in May. And the same-sex couples in the class action have been granted permission to intervene in that case to assert their rights. Joining us is Claire Gostiniaga, the executive director of the Virginia ACLU. Thanks for joining us, Claire.
Good morning, May Lily. How are you?
Just great.
wonderful.
What does this mean?
Well, you know, judge did stay our case, but he did it because the ACLU and Lambda are fully engaged in the Fourth Circuit arguments that are going to be held on May 13th.
Okay, so we shouldn't read into this.
Nothing. We told the judge that we had successfully motioned to intervene in the appeals case in the pending Fourth Circuit appeal, and I think he, you know, from a perspective of judicial economy, he said, you know, when the Fourth Circuit rules, I'll reopen this and make a final decision based on the Fourth Circuit's ruling. So he recognized that our plaintiffs and the class that they represent, all 14,000 and some couples in Virginia who are either married or want to get married, who are same-sex, that that class is going to be fully represented at the Fourth Circuit in the appeal, and the arguments are going to be held May 13th, so watch this space.
Rewind to 1967, Loving versus Virginia, which looked at interracial marriage, which was something that was also banned in Virginia. How much is that going to factor in this debate and in this court decision?
Well, in all of the court decisions that have been issued so far, the Loving case has been very much the single most important precedent cited by any of the judges. And, you know, there are now about 60 cases moving their way through various both state and federal courts across the country. And, you know, it's exciting for us at the ACLU of Virginia. Two of our founding members, Bernie Cohen and Phil Hirschkopf, were the lawyers who took Loving versus Virginia to the United States Supreme Court. So every time the case is cited, we smile a little that our heritage is, you know, influencing this issue so profoundly nationwide.
A lot of money has been put into defending traditional marriage. Explain.
Well, I mean, and one of the things that we try to help people understand is these cases are not about changing the definition of marriage or moving away from traditional marriage. These cases are all about giving everyone the equal access to the traditional kind of marriage that has always existed. Two people who love each other and want to create a family and have the protections that the government recognition gives their relationship, whether it's protections that relate to both parties being able to adopt their children or whether it's having you know, equal treatment under the tax code, I mean, or the benefits under Medicare or Medicaid, or being able to inherit from your spouse. Nobody's looking for anything new or different. They're just looking for access to the same old, same old. So we don't view these cases in any way, shape, or form a threat to what anybody would consider traditional in a marriage.
Here's what Reuters released this week. A majority of Virginia voters support gay marriage, according to the poll released Monday. It comes in conjunction with this lawsuit. Some 50% of voters in Virginia backed gay marriage, while 42% opposed it. So when I talked about the funding, I just was referring to those who are funding the legal aspect of this. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of money on the on that side of the fence.
Well, there's been money on both sides. I mean, there are a combination of things going on here. I mean, there are groups like the ACLU that are committing substantial, you know, human resources to these issues, and there are people on the other side who are hiring private lawyers or funding organizations that provide these kinds of services on the other side of the issue. So it's not surprising that there's a lot invested, and certainly in the various campaigns that have been had, there's been a lot of money raised and spent to advocate for one position over the other. One of the interesting things I think a lot of people don't know is back in 2006, you know, almost a million people in Virginia supported gay marriage even in 2006. And the, you know, number of votes on the other side was obviously greater than a million. It was about 1.3 million. But, you know, when you've got a million people on both sides of an issue, even if the poll doesn't say 50-50, it does suggest that there's substantial support. And the polling over the last 5-6 years has moved in the direction of more support for marriage, but a majority of Virginians have always been, even back in 2006, for some recognition of same-sex relationships, either marriage or civil unions. And what's really happened is that people have come to accept that equal access to the government benefit of civil marriage is something that everyone should have, is entitled to.
Claire Gastanaga, Executive Director of the Virginia ACLU. Thanks so much, Claire, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, May Lily. Hope to see you again soon.
Take care. Julian.
And I think Claire raises a lot of valid points. I mean, the polling data this week from Quinnipiac did show that it was 50-42%. That's consistent with what we saw in a Q poll from this time last year, last July, I should say, where it was 50-43. So that's one thing to bear in mind. Another thing to kind of take it from both a governmental and political perspective is the attorney general has reversed the position of the previous attorney general, Mark Herring, the current attorney general, Democrat, reversed the position of Ken Cuccinelli, Republican, former attorney general, on this case. He's now fighting to overturn both the statutory language and the constitutional amendment that Claire referred to from 2006, prohibiting gay marriage by defining marriage as between one man and one woman solely. So there's that element as well, and that – if we look ahead beyond just the issue of equal access to government rights that Claire brought up, there is the question of what this means politically for someone like Mark Herring as he triangulates and positions, presumably, for the 2017 statewide contest in Virginia.
Okay. And, you know, we want to go back to the issue of Medicaid expansion one more time because we do have some more callers who want to chime in on that discussion. Let's go to Mary from Augusta County. Good morning to you, Mary.
Hello.
Yes. Hi.
I am calling because I also live in the same general area of one of your first callers who was represented in the General Assembly by Dickie Bell and Emmett Hanger. And I just wanted to add that to that I am represented by Emmett Hanger, who I think is being very reasonable about the Medicaid expansion, and I hope that his friends and fellow thinkers will eventually win out.
What specifically, Mary, do you find reasonable?
Well, I think that we need to, the representatives of the state of Virginia should be thinking about the people who need some help in Virginia, and I'm thinking that Emmett Hanger is thinking about all of the people of Virginia, and he is also aware that the hospitals are hurting if we do not expand Medicaid. And I have written and talked with my delegate, who is Steve Landis, several times, and we finally have come to the position that we have to agree to disagree because he is definitely with Dickie Bell on this, and I think that Emmett Hanger has correct position.
Mary, we appreciate your call.
Thank you.
The hospitals around the state feel very strongly about this. It's a business matter as far as they are concerned. They don't apologize for that. There are hospitals around the state. One in far southwest Virginia had to close because of continuing cash flow issues. There's evidence of contraction and realignment, you know, pick your metaphor. At hospitals and health centers elsewhere in Virginia, that because of uncertainty over Medicaid have resulted in the ratcheting down of services. The hospital industry says more of this is likely if this problem isn't solved.
Julian?
I think that's absolutely right. There is considerable concern among the hospital community, and that is why they are putting so much lobbying muscle into this. They have hired a phalanx of people in the persuasive class, if you will. And furthermore, they've even brought on board several McDonnell administration alums, one former secretary, another agency head, another deputy secretary. So they're bringing out the big guns, bringing all their resources to bear because they think this is such a critical financial issue for them.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Conversations. That's Julian Walker of the Virginian Pilot. I want to thank him. And I want to thank the spectacled Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Thanks to both of you for joining. And thanks to you, our listeners, for making this a conversation. On the next edition of Virginia Conversations, Closing the Gap Between Farm and Table, Urban Agriculture in Virginia. That's next time. And be sure to check out all of our past shows at virginiapublicradio.org. Look us up at Virginia Conversations. See you next time. I'm May Lily Lee. Have a great week. We'll be right back.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.